About 25 years ago now, I became conscious that in our churches, our people, many of them, know by name a great number of stalwarts of the faith in past history. But they don't know them as people. They put them on pedestals and forget that they were men of like passions. And I've been impressed over the years at how God uses men. God uses human instruments. I've said this so many times. God uses human instruments to accomplish divine purpose. He rarely uses miracles as men would define them. We sometimes say God miraculously, and then we finish the sentence. And as far as we're concerned, it's true. But it has not meant the suspending of natural laws and the turning of water into wine and causing the sun to stand still in its going down, as he is well able to do, still, as necessary. But he uses human, men call it coincidences. But God works out all things after the counsel of his own will. And I began to try to put together some biographical sketches in a less lecture-type presentation. Started with Martin Luther, my favorite reformer. And Reformation was my main theme. And then branched out to Calvin and John Knox and William Tyndale and John Bunyan and John Wesley and Charles Spurgeon. And the Lord has given me a ministry in semi-retirement in that realm. We're dealing with battles, past and present. The battles I'm talking about in this hour and then after the evening meal are in the past. A half millennium in the past. They were battles between Romanism and the gospel. And some of them paid with their lives in fighting that battle. Others who did not were no less faithful and used of heaven. In the city of Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland, are really two cities. They're divided by a deep chasm, a ravine, which today spans by a modern bridge. The lower part of the city is the new city. It is modern and of about two centuries age. And in that lower city stands a Gothic spire, as if it were on a cathedral, but it isn't. It's on the ground. Its foundation is on the ground. It stands six or seven stories tall. And in the top of it, through stone lacework, one sees a statue of Sir Walter Scott, the great Scottish novelist and poet. That's fine. The upper city is the old city. It is essentially 1 mile long street. It's the high street. It's the high part of town. They call it the high street. At one end is the Edinburgh Castle, symbolic of political authority, impregnable and impossible to storm, being protected by the ravine. At the other end of that mile long street is the castle, Holyrood Castle, where the Queen, the King, reside. Exactly halfway in the middle of that street, at the half-mile marker, is St. Giles Cathedral. St. Giles became the pulpit of John Knox. And as he stood in that pulpit, the position of the pulpit was such that as he stood behind it, he faced the palace a half mile away. If you look for a statue of John Knox, you go to the back of the church outside and see a small, just about life size, close to the ground, statue that nobody knows is there unless you go looking for it. If you look for the grave of John Knox, you look a few feet away at the parking lot in front of the building which had been earlier the Parliament Building of Scotland. Before, in recent years, they built a new one, but when Parliament was absorbed by London, Westminster, that building became the Supreme Court of Scotland. And you see a paved area in front of the building, a parking lot paved by MacAdam, a Scottish contractor. MacAdam, that was his name. He developed the MacAdam blacktop. And you see lines, painted lines, parking spaces. And you ask the attendant in the parking lot, where is Knox's grave? And he points you to a certain parking space. And he says, we believe that under where the rear right wheel of an automobile in that space sits is where Knox was buried. There is a small, it is not 6 inches across, bronze plate. It's plain, nothing on it, embedded in that. And it has been said there is no monument to John Knox. There is not even a grave for John Knox. For Scotland is his monument. Look around you if you seek his grave. For a few minutes, I want to ask your imagination to work as I assume the person of John Knox and tell you the story of my life. I was born in the first decade, probably, of the 16th century. There's an argument over whether it was 1505 or 1514. Doesn't really matter. My parents know. I don't remember. Born in a land that was priest-ridden, the church dominated the state. You know nothing of this in your culture, in your century. You talk about such strange terms as separation of church and state, an idea unknown 5 centuries ago. Monasteries were cesspools of iniquity, and the people knew it. In Scotland in the 16th century. The Scots and the English were not good friends, as you may remember. The Scots looked upon the English as sophisticated snobs. And the English looked upon us Scots as barbarian boors. You remember that a wall had been built back in Roman times, to separate England from Scotland, Hadrian's Wall. And there had been no eagerness to tear it down for centuries. My family was able to provide for me an education, and I was able to go to St. Andrew's University. St. Andrew, Andrew the Apostle, was the traditional apostle to the British Isles. And there I prepared the profession to become a priest, and in 1536 was ordained a priest in the Church of Rome. In 1524, a young man named Patrick Hamilton, who had gone to Wittenberg, where Luther was a member of the faculty at the university, and there he drank at the stream, at the source of the Reformation in Germany. He came back to Scotland and he preached. 24 years of age, he preached the message of the gospel. And it was said that every line, every sentence of his sermon was another faggot for the flames. And he was burned at the stake by Cardinal Beaton, B-E-A-T-O-N. He was the practical ruler of the land, under the king, to be sure. But the church dominated, I say, the state. It was later said to Cardinal Beaton, if you must burn heretics, burn them in the cellar. For the smoke of Hamilton's burning has infected all on whom it blew. In 1546, the year of Luther's death, another burning, another preacher of righteousness, George Wishart, my friend, my companion. I carried a two-handled claymore sword, and I was ready, like Peter in the garden, to defend my friend. And Wishart said, no, John, you stay and serve another day. I did. I came to understand the gospel of Jesus Christ by reading through Paul's epistles. I had no personal worker. I had no evangelist. I came by the wooing of the Spirit of God and the reading of the Word of God to an understanding of the truth of God. And I became a preacher of righteousness. I must tell you about the political situation. I must bore you as a history teacher for a moment. King Henry VII of England, father to Henry VIII, was also father to Margaret Tudor, Henry VIII's sister. And in an effort to woo the Scots and win their friendship after centuries of conflict, he, the king, married the daughter, Margaret, to the king of Scotland. Sought to win the favor and friendship by a marriage. James IV and Margaret Tudor married. As the next generation emerged, from that marriage came James V, son to that marriage. He resented the effort of his father and mother to be wooed by England, and he deliberately married a French princess. Now you must understand that the French and the English had been enemies for centuries. Only in your time, in your past century, had they become on the same side in your modern wars. But in my time, they had been for centuries enemies. A few of you remember the Hundred Years' War in the 14th and 15th centuries, England versus France. I say a few of you remember, perhaps very few. And resenting, I say, deliberately snubbing the English effort, the King of Scotland married into the French royalty. Now, Mary of Lorraine was her name, the wife to James V. She was a French woman through and through. She married the Scottish king, but in her eyes, the Scots were boors and uncultured, and she had no desire even to live long in Scotland. Worse, she did not want her daughter, born to that marriage, to be reared in Scotland. So, when the daughter was old enough to leave home as a child, weaned from her mother, she, the queen mother, sent her daughter, Mary, you know her as Mary, Queen of Scots, Mary Stuart, to France to be reared in the proper French home. to be reared in French culture and French manners and French fashion. And before long, it became apparent in French morals as well. And while the Queen Mother, Mary, remained in Scotland of necessity as the regent for her daughter, at the death of the father, at the death of James V, the daughter became the Queen of Scotland. But a queen as a child is not very able to perform royal functions. And therefore, the Queen Mother stood in her place as regent, the one reigning, ruling in behalf of. All right. That's the political situation in my time. Now, I join as a chaplain a group of nobility who had stormed the castle where Cardinal Beaton in St. Andrews, the university to which I attended, St. Andrews, the castle, Cardinal Beaton dominated it, and the nobility stormed the castle and murdered the cardinal. They had said at the time of Beaton's burning of Wishart, my friend, you loll on a sofa in the window of the upper story overlooking the courtyard where Wishart is being burned. But ere long, Cardinal, another sight shall be witnessed from that window. And it was from that window that they dangled the hanging dead form of Cardinal Beaton. I became the chaplain of this group. You may wonder at that. I became the tutor to the sons of that group. And before long, the French were invited to come and storm the castle and under deceit take the castle, take the inhabitants, including me. And we became galley slaves on a French ship for 19 months. Through the cold of two winters and the heat of one summer, I and my comrades were chained to the oarlocks of a French galley as we plied the seas. They were able well to enforce discipline. Their method was a slanted board on which an offender was placed head downward and face downward. That is, the head was at the lower part of the slanted board, and the face was on the board. And they flayed the back of the offender. On one occasion, they brought on board a painted image, a wooden image of the Virgin, and passed it among us prisoners at the oarlocks, requiring us to kiss the image. As it came to me with what little purchase we had with the chains, I was able to take it, and seeming to prepare to kiss it, I plunged it overboard into the sea. And I said, let Our Lady swim. She is more fit to swim than to be kissed. I tasted the slanted board as a result. But never again did they require that of us. After the 19 months, the king, the boy king of England, Edward VI, came to our rescue and arranged the release. And in gratitude, I went to the border between Scotland and England, the town of Berwick, and there became a pastor for the remaining years of Edward, the boy king's reign. But then after Edward VI of England came the Bloody Mary. In 1553, now preachers of righteousness, preachers of the gospel were to be divided into two groups. Marian martyrs or Marian exiles. I chose to be an exile lest I become a martyr. He whom you will meet later this evening at the same time became a Marian martyr. But whether by life or by death, God was to be honored. And the battles were not a word only, but they were unto death. I fled to the continent, first to Frankfurt, Germany, and then soon made my way to Geneva. Geneva, John Calvin there, 3 years my junior, but I deferred to him as my teacher. John Calvin saw in the scriptures four ecclesiastical offices, regular offices: pastor, teacher, elder, and deacon. You tend in your generation to join pastor teacher into one. In Geneva's congregation, they were two. And I became the designated teacher. This does not mean reading, writing, and arithmetic. It meant Bible teacher. Now, there were no such things as Sunday schools in my time. And the people, the congregations, attended weekday services of Bible teaching. The preaching was exhorting. The Bible teaching was learning the content of Scripture. And a chapel was built next to St. Peter's Cathedral in Geneva. St. Peter's Cathedral had become John Calvin's pulpit. He had removed from it all the trappings of Romanism. It was a kind of a figuratively whitewashed cathedral. It wasn't white, but it was now stone. I mean, it was all stone. All the trappings of Romanism had been removed. Adjacent to it was built, and there stands a modern version of it today there, what is now known as the John Knox Chapel, a small chapel, church building, in which I taught the scriptures. But I learned much in Geneva, much that I was soon to implement in Edinburgh, in my own land. In 1560, the Queen Mother died, the regent for the daughter. By that time, Mary, the Queen, now a late teenager, had become a young widow before she was 20. She had married the King's son at the time, who soon became the King, Francis II. Now, the Scottish, in her absence, were very troubled at this. And if no child were born to that marriage, Scotland would become a part of France. If a child were born to that marriage, that child would be monarch of both France and Scotland. And the Scottish nobility were bracing for a conflict. They had become so fed up with popery that they, under the Scottish nobility, the lords of the congregation, as they were called, drew up a covenant and determined that the Reformed gospel shall be the Church of Scotland. Now, just as papacy, Romanism, had been the Church of Scotland by political determination, now, equally, by political determination, Reformed Protestantism was to be the religion. Mary, the young queen, in Paris, was informed of this fact and temporized, did not agree with it or disagree with it, voted her time, because soon she was to return to assume her rightful role as Queen of Scotland. I had returned in 1559 to Scotland. The Queen Mother died, and soon Mary, Queen of Scots, returns to Scotland to assume her kingdom. She is an alien in her own kingdom. She knows not its language, its people, its character, and now its religion. She is a papist. A part of the determination of the decrees of the Lords of the Congregation was that the Mass, the Romanist Mass, was to be outlawed in Scotland. Hallelujah, you will say. The Queen came. The Queen came to Holyrood Palace, took up residence, and in her royal chapel had her private priest perform a Mass in the land which had outlawed that as a heathen abomination to be feared more greatly than the landing of a French army, as I once put it. I entered my pulpit at St. Giles. I faced the Queen in my usual position behind the pulpit. I faced the half-mile palace away. And I condemned the action of the Queen. Of all people, she was responsible to uphold the law. She, of all people, broke the law. The law the people had placed in power. And I said it was wrong. I did not denounce the Queen. I denounced the action of the Queen. I received the next day a summons to the presence of the Queen as she heard of my action. I respectfully responded to the summons. She, in her late teens, a young widow, practiced in French culture, used all the weapons in the feminine arsenal to cajole, bribe, threaten, plead with this preacher. What have you to do with my religion? My conscience tells me my religion is right, she said. I replied, conscience, madam, demandeth knowledge. And of right knowledge, I fear thou hast none. I was respectful. I did not. She said, soon my people will be obeying you rather than me. Madam, it is more important that both obey God. I should be back in my study, Your Majesty. You will not long be in your study. Madam, I expect I shall be longer in my study than you shall be on the throne. Have any of you been reared on Mother Goose rhymes? In my time, if you had a quarrel with the government, you did not write a letter to the editor of your, what do you call them, newspapers? No. The people made up little ditties which the adults understood. The children in ignorance would sing them in the streets. You know some of them. One of them, Little Miss Muffet, sat on a tuffet. You heard this? There weren't many responses. The generation is declining. Little Miss Muffet is Mary, Queen of Scots. The tuffet is her throne. eating her curds and whey, doing whatever she wanted to do. Along came a spider. That's me. Sat down and had these conversations at the Queen's insistence and frightened Miss Muffet away. She was indeed deposed. I was indeed longer in my study than she was on the throne. I was described as short of stature, broad-shouldered, with ample black hair, a black beard, a piercing eye, a thick lip, and a stout heart. I have been called the Thundering Scot. It was said by others that I flayed the pulpit to shreds, and its surface had regularly to be replaced. I started softly, warmed to my text, and proceeded to slay the devil. St. Giles was my throne, my kelp, my pulpit. The queen, I say, was a widow in her teens. She made a mess of her private life, as well as offending the spiritual leadership of the land. She married her cousin, Lord Darnley, upon coming to Scotland. He loved her. He discovered his wife, the Queen, in a dalliance with an Italian male secretary who had liaison with her. Darnley, the husband, came upon them in an illicit state, was enraged in passion, dragged Rizzio, the Italian, into the hall, murdered him in a rage of passion. And the queen arranged the murder of her husband, who had murdered her lover. She had the Earl of Bothwell take him on a hunting expedition to a lodge in the country. Strangely, that night the lodge burned down and Darnley, the Queen's husband, was burned in the fire. The Earl of Bothwell was not. And Mary, the Queen, within months, married the Earl of Bothwell, which everybody had believed had been instrumental in the death of Henry Darnley. But with the marriage of Henry and Mary, had been born a son, James by name. And upon the exiling, the deposing of Mary the Queen, that infant son became James the sixth of Scotland, and at the same time, James the first of England. The authorized version of the scriptures, so-called King James Version, with which James had relatively little to do, is named after him. I preached the coronation ceremony for this infant son, James. I had a wife and three daughters. I had two sons also. Both of them died at university, both of the sons. From the three daughters came the only successors in my family that subsequently lived. One married a pastor named Welsh, Josiah Welsh, who in the 17th century, her husband, the pastor, was imprisoned by the King of England for having preached without ecclesiastical license from the Church of England. and she, my daughter, went for an audience with the king, pleading that his imprisonment be transferred to Scotland where she could visit him more easily. She did not ask for his release. And the king is supposed to reply through the intermediaries, "Yes, I'll be glad to transfer him if he will accept a license from the Church of England." And my dear daughter stood back, raised the corners of her over garment like an apron over her tunic, held it out before her and said, "I would rather have his head here." And the king is supposed to have said upon hearing that, "I'm glad your father had only lassies and no laddies, else I would have had no peace in any of my three kingdoms, England, Scotland, or Wales." I was proud of her. My wife had died. I later remarried. You will smile. The marriage was called the marriage of May and October. She was 15. I was in my 50s. I was October. In 1572, I preached my last sermon in St. Giles. 1572, I was, depending on my birth date, in my 60s or so, installed my successor in the pulpit, leaned upon a staff and the arm of a friend as I walked from the church to my home on High Street. The street was lined with my people. And it was as if the street was bathed in the light of a people's love. And my broad shoulders went through the doorway of my home, not again to emerge in life. My secretary, my friend, my male friend, asked me on that dying bed for a word that I still held to all I had preached. I held up three fingers and I said, "It is well with my body, with my soul, and with my spirit." I preached on that last Sunday on the crucifixion. Friday of the week, as I lay dying, I thought it was Sunday and I wanted to preach on the resurrection. And I asked my dear wife to read to me 1 Corinthians 15. She did. At about 6 p.m. that day, my family retired for evening prayers. They went to an adjacent room. When they had finished, they returned and asked if I had heard their praying. And I said, "I heard a heavenly sound." At 10 in the evening of that same day, I asked my dear wife to read to me from that chapter where I first cast my anchor. John 17. She did. And a little before midnight, I hoisted anchor for the last time in the ark on which I had traveled these many years, reached port, and the anchor was dropped. for the last time. At my funeral, the political official in charge declared, "Here lies one who neither feared nor flattered any flesh. And though he hath oft been troubled with pistol and dagger, yet at last he has come to honor and peace. Look not around you. Look not for my monument. Scotland is my monument." And if I may step out of his character and tell you that years ago, after his death, in his books and papers, I came upon a postcard written by my mentor, Dr. Charles Brokenshire, a good and godly man, a favorite teacher, a very little man in body, large in spirit and mind, a man who had been trained in the languages at Princeton, by Robert Dick Wilson, who knew languages so well that at his oral examination for the completion of his advanced degree, Dr. Wilson asked the young Brokenshire questions which he knew Wilson's fellow faculty members on the committee could not themselves answer, to demonstrate the ability of this young student. Dr. Brokenshire was my mentor and teacher. And he had taken a trip. He was trained also in Germany. He had taken a trip to Scotland, and he, in large flourishing hand, had written a postcard to a nephew. He was unmarried. He rode a bicycle for circulation purposes. He was almost as wide as he was tall, and he was probably 5 feet tall. We once asked him, "Why did you never marry, Dr. Brokenshire?" And he scruffed his chin and smiled and said, "Well, sir," he said, "whenever I saw anybody I was interested in, I discovered she was taken." Anyway, he had written this postcard, and he had written all over it, and there was no space left for the address to send it to. So it remained in his papers. And he said that in that brief message from Edinburgh, "John Knox, Scotland is his monument." And to his nephew, he was saying, "May you be such a man." Only a man, John Knox, but a man whom God used, a man whom God honored for his faithfulness. The conflict was a different one from those in our times. It was a foundational conflict between popery and gospel preaching. A nation had been preserved, had been prepared, and was prepared to present to your country through the planting in Ulster and Northern Ireland, the Scots-Irish, who have given more presidents to your country than any other nationality. Solid. Not Baptists, but also solid. God be praised.